With. Translation, this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is an illiterate sannyasi and therefore does not know his real function. Guided only by his sentiments, he wanders about in the company of other sentimentalists. Purport, foolish Mayavadis, not knowing that the Krishna consciousness movement is based on a solid philosophy of transcendental science, superficially conclude that those who dance and chant do not have philosophical knowledge. Those who are Krishna conscious actually have full knowledge of the essence of Vedanta philosophy, for they study the real commentary on Vedanta Sutra, Srimad Bhagavatam, and follow the actual words of the Supreme Personality of God as found in Bhagavad Gita as it is. After understanding the Bhagavata philosophy or Bhagavata Dharma, they become fully spiritually conscious or Krishna conscious. And therefore, their chanting and dancing is not material, but is on the spiritual platform. Although everyone admires the ecstatic chanting and dancing of the devotees, who are therefore popularly known as the Hare Krishna people, Mayavadis cannot appreciate these activities because of their poor fund of knowledge. Translation, this Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is an illiterate sannyasi and therefore does not know his real function. Guided only by his sentiments, he wanders about in the company of other sentimentalists. So this is a criticism of Lord Chaitanya by some Mayavadi sannyasis. Now, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself took sannyas from a Mayavadi, and therefore he had a sannyas name similar to the Mayavadis. His guru was identified being in a certain group within the sannyasis of the Mayavad camp. He had the dress of a Mayavad sannyasi and the hairstyle of a Mayavad sannyasi. So he had the appearance of a Mayavad sannyasi. And he had met these Mayavadis, but they began to criticize him. Even though he looked similar, his activities were much different. So therefore they gave this criticism. So, of course, sannyasa is a part of the varnashram system. It is the fourth ashram, and those who are brahmanas are qualified to take it if they are very renounced. Lord Chaitanya took it when he was very young, actually, he was married. That's possible. According to the rules of scripture, but often we see that a person takes sannyas after many, many years in grihastha life. And this is the tradition usually in the Ramanuja Sampradaya. You know, they're very old and they've passed through grihastha life, then they take sannyas. He took when he was very young and he was actually married. So at the same time, the sannyas itself was, we could say in one sense, a little controversial because he is a Vaishnava, so why would he take Mayavad sannyas? Mayavad is completely opposed to the philosophy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is a Vaishnava. And Lord Chaitanya criticizes the Mayavadis very heavily, as all other Vaishnavas do also. So Lord Chaitanya was always criticizing and condemning that philosophy, yet he looked like Mayavad sannyas. But he never acted like a Mayavadi. He's acting completely different. So we cannot blame him for becoming a Mayavadi or anything. He just took the sannyas dress of a Mayavadi. So this is the fourth ashram, and we have the two groups. We have those impersonalists, and we have those who are Vaishnavas. So we do have Vaishnava sannyasis also, the Ramanuja Sampradaya, the Madhva Sampradaya, they have sannyasis there. Not very common in Vallabha Sampradaya, I don't think they have any. Maybe Nabarkas have a few, but maybe not also. Anyway, it's a common practice or well-known practice among the Vaishnavas also. And then we have the Mayavad. So the sannyas itself does not indicate Vaishnava or non-Vaishnava, it simply indicates renunciation. not getting married, not being married, or having a relationship with women. So unfortunately, the Mayavad sannyasis have become very prominent in India, and they had been very prominent for a long time. So sannyas is often associated with Mayavad philosophy. So this started with Shankaracharya. He started a whole line of renunciates or sannyasis. And what is wrong with this philosophy? In one sense, there is nothing wrong with it on an absolute platform. It was there for a certain purpose, that is to defeat Buddhism and to accept the Vedas, so that it did very nicely. But in terms of content, the philosophy is very different and very much opposed to the Vaishnava ideas that there's a Supreme Lord and there's a Jiva and we establish an eternal relationship of worshipping the Lord. They don't accept that. So another, they don't even accept the Jiva as being real. Jiva is also illusory. And this material world is illusory also. And so the only thing that exists is Brahman, which has no form, no qualities, and no activities. So it is mere, they say, chinmatra, consciousness alone and nothing else. And it's not conscious of anything, because there's nothing to see. Everything is illusory. So it's just consciousness existing by itself in a static state. That's Brahman realization. And there's no jiva, there's no, it's all illusory. It's called covered Buddhism because it's similar to Buddhist philosophy in that ultimately everything is illusion, except that in Mayavada philosophy, Brahman is not illusion, but everything else is illusion. In Buddhist philosophy, everything is illusion. There's no Brahman also. So nothing in the world exists?
Nothing exists,
that's all. So Mayavada philosophy, Brahman exists, but it has no form, quality, or activity, so it's kind of like that sunya idea. But it says, Brahman, call it Brahman, call the sunya Brahman. Call the absence of everything Brahman. So that's called covered Buddhism. This was a tactic to have everyone accept the Vedic authority at least. So Shankaracharya argued for this Brahman and the Mayavada philosophy by accepting the Vedas and proving it through Vedic literature. So in other words, he says, you don't have to reject the Vedas if you want to be Buddhist-like. You can be like a Buddhist, but you follow the Vedas. So you become a Mayavadi. And this was propagated by the different philosophers. And the head of the authority in the group is the sannyasi. You know, he becomes the acharya. And people follow him. So this philosophy did defeat Buddhism. Of course, Buddhism at one time was very strong in India. It was like a national religion of India. Ashoka became a Buddhist, and he was the king of India, so a lot of people became Buddhists. And it spread all over India. And then, it spread beyond India into Burma and Thailand and that area and Indonesia, etc. Into China even, and of course Tibet, Mongolia, China, and Japan. It spread all over the place. So it was quite strong, but Shankaracharya managed to have people accept this Mayavada philosophy, and then Buddhism began to dwindle away. So that over 500 years, let's say, it became very insignificant. At Lord Chaitanya's time, there were a few Buddhists left. Ramanuja's time, 500 years before that, there were some Buddhists also, a few Buddhists, not so many. After Shankaracharya, gradually they declined until nowadays we hardly see anything there at all in India. So we can say that Shankaracharya was the one who actually combated that Buddhism with a similar philosophy, but with acceptance of the Vedas at least. So his mission ultimately as a devotee, as an incarnation of Shiva, was to have people accept the Vedic authority at least. Based on that, then there could be using the Veda to establish Vaishnava philosophy after that. So it was one step towards the establishment of the Vaishnava philosophy. So after Shankaracharya established his philosophy, then later on we have the appearance of Ramanujacharya, and then Madhvacharya, and others, Nimbarka, etc., and finally Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The Vaishnava philosophies were established on the Veda, based on the Veda also. So he had a certain purpose, but nevertheless we reject his philosophy, and we'll see in all of the Vaishnava acharyas they rather passionately attack all the ideas that Shankaracharya is proposing, and all of his shastric proofs that he gives, and all of his logic. They attack everything about his conclusions. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was the same. But nevertheless, he did accept a sannyas, which wasn't a Vaishnava sannyas, but it was a Mayavad sannyas. And therefore, when he appeared in Varanasi, he appeared as with a Mayavadi dress, but he did not act like a Mayavadi at all. So what is the conduct of a Mayavadi? The Mayavadi sannyasis are, we could say, intellectual, largely intellectual, and they study Upanishads, like Chandogya Upanishad, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and then they also study the Vedanta Sutras, because the Vedanta Sutras are a commentary on difficult passages of the Upanishads. So they'll discuss about Brahman and Atma and different processes to realize Atma and Brahman. The Mayavadi sannyasis concentrate on this study. And Shankaracharya wrote a huge commentary on the Brahma Sutras and on the 10 principal Upanishads, which you say are the essence of the Vedas. And in that he established this Mayavad philosophy that only Brahman exists, everything else is illusion. And the process of realizing this is jnana. The reason for illusion is ignorance, avidya. So the solution is to get knowledge, vidya. So what is knowledge? Study of Upanishads and Vedanta Sutra according to the commentaries of Shankaracharya. You get your knowledge, then you realize Brahman, then you're free of illusion. So that's his whole process. So it is largely scholastic, and in that there is use of logic. He argues based on logic. And why did he do that? Of course, we see in the Rupa Goswami's commentary on the Nectar Devotion there at the end of that first part, you say, well, logic is apratishta, it is insubstantial. One argument will give rise to somebody else's argument, and that will get accepted, and that argument will be defeated, somebody will start another argument. So it's unending. There's no real conclusion just by using logic. So that's why we don't give that the main place. But in Shankara's philosophy, they use a lot of this logic to establish their principles. So they'll use that logic to defeat the Buddhists, and also to defeat any other interpretation of the Upanishads or Vedanta Sutra or even Bhagavad Gita. They just use their logical process. Why they did is because the Buddhists were very logical. They use logic to establish nothingness, that nothing exists based on logic. So Shankaracharya also had to use logic to defeat the Buddhists. Plus, he had to establish and convince the people of who were trying to accept the Vedas that this is actually stated in the Vedic literature, all of this Mayavad philosophy. So he had to use logic to, do that. So he convinced many, impressed many people. He could debate with people and defeat them. So he would defeat the Buddhists, he would defeat the Karma Mimamsakas, who didn't believe in liberation at all. Svargaloka was the ultimate for them. And that was also very strong in India. These are the ones that Buddha was against, because they were into animal sacrifices. But they also developed very strong attachment to Vedas. So, but it was obviously not the highest concept. So he had to argue with them also. And they also had some logical arguments. So he used logic to a high degree in his whole process. And discussion of grammatical rules, because Sanskrit, the meaning of things is based on grammar. And if you misinterpret the grammar, then you can't have the proper meaning. So, but then the grammar is a little flexible sometimes, so you can argue over what the meaning is by quoting one grammatical rule to interpret it in another way. They use a lot of grammar and grammatical arguments to support their ideas about nothingness and our Brahman, etc. The sannyasis of that movement dedicate a lot of their time to studying Vedanta, trying to understand the logical arguments of Shankaracharya and his followers. The other point is that they also, as we saw yesterday in discussion of vairagya or detachment, they are the Phagu vairagis, which we don't practice. They renounce things as being maya. So they practice detachment from things, austerities and detachment. Because material objects are a temptation for the senses, which will lead us into desire and into activity and into karma. So they want to get rid of all karma. So they have to practice detachment. So they don't want to do activities, they don't want to look at objects, they don't want to engage in handling objects or anything. So that's what the Mayavadis do. So Lord Chaitanya was not like that, because even though he had a Mayavadi dress, and therefore they would expect him to do similarly, he didn't do that. What did he do? He chanted the holy name. And the Mayavadis regarded that as something very, very, very low. It had nothing to do with the Shankar's philosophy. Why are you running around with people chanting? You have to study Vedanta, sit and study Vedanta very seriously. Even Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who was also another Mayavadi in Puri, he told Lord Chaitanya, you have to study Vedanta, be very serious. Why Lord Chaitanya was doing this, of course, is because he wasn't a Mayavadi sannyasi at all. He just had the dress of a Mayavadi sannyasi, but he was a great devotee. And we see after he got his initiation, Vaishnava initiation in Gaya, and he got his mantra, and he took up chanting the holy name, that he could not stop hearing about Krishna, discussing about Krishna, and chanting the name of Krishna. He became like a madman after that point, so much so that his students, his grammar students, thought he was crazy because he wasn't teaching grammar anymore. He wasn't in the normal way. Everything is related to Krishna. So they were thinking he's gone crazy or something. And that was in Navadvipa. So he was spontaneously displaying symptoms of ecstasy and always chanting the name of Krishna, thinking about Krishna, etc. So, in spite of having a sannyasi dress, he was doing very strange activities for a sannyasi, something quite different. That's why the sannyasis began to criticize him. So he's a murka, which means actually a fool. He's a real idiot sannyasi. And it says nija dharma nahi. He doesn't know nija dharma, which means the sannyas dharma. Of course, according to the Mayavadis, the sannyasi should be very serious, shouldn't associate with other people, shouldn't sing and dance. These are material activities. He should sit in his room and study Vedanta all the time and be detached from everything. So that's the nija dharma of the sannyasi. So he doesn't know all that at all. He's why? Because he's ignorant. He's foolish. So we have to educate him. So this, of course, is a misconception. They don't understand that actually he's not a Mayavadi, he's a Vaishnava, but he's just got the sannyas dress of a Mayavadi. And it says, bhavuka hoya, he's become a bhavuka. So that, for the sannyasi, this is a negative meaning, it's a criticism. Bhavuka is one who has bhava, so he's a sentimentalist, he's very emotional. But it's material emotion. He's emotional, like sometimes even here, we'll say people come in the temple and they cry and whatever like that. So we say, okay, they're sahajis or something. So emotional on a material level, not on a genuine spiritual level. On the other hand, the same word we use in a very respectful way. Like in the Bhagavatam, in the third verse, that the Bhavukas, these are the ones who will drink the nectar of the Bhagavatam. They have a real taste for the Bhagavatam because they have some sort of attachment to worshiping the Lord and getting an experience from relishing the Lord and His name, His form, His qualities, activities, etc. So that's the positive aspect of a Bhavuka. It doesn't always mean, you know, some low person who's just sentimentally expressing his emotions. So on the highest level, it means one who experiences spiritually a relationship with the Lord. So we have in our layers, our levels of bhakti, we have sadhana bhakti, then we have bhav bhakti and prem bhakti. So when you come to bhav bhakti, then we can say you're a bhavuka, because you have the sthayi bhava in your experience, you experience this bhava. We explained yesterday also there's two aspects of the anusilanam. One was the cheshta, one was the bhava, bhava rupa bhakti. So if you have bhava rupa bhakti, then you become a bhavaka. You have a great feeling for the Lord spontaneously, because it's your emotional attachment to the Lord. Yeah, there's the chesta rupa bhakti, the activities. So of course Lord Chaitanya had both. He had the emotional sentiments, and he also had the activities like hearing and chanting and dancing, etc., which are the chesta rupa bhakti. And what the chesta was expressing his, the activities were expressing his great bhava, his great emotional attachment to the Lord. So nothing wrong with that. That is, you know, high level of bhakti. Of course, Lord Chaitanya is Supreme Lord, but he's playing the role of a devotee. So he was experiencing ecstatic symptoms, etc., and displaying them. So for the Mayavadis, when they see this, they will dismiss it all as material. All of these singing, dancing, etc., are expressions of material sentiments. If you experience Brahman and the bliss of Brahman, you simply become very peaceful. Freedom from desire, freedom from karmas, etc. So it's a rather negative type of bliss. The bliss of Brahman is the absence of material suffering and karma. So that's their goal. So if somebody is jumping up and down and dancing and singing, it's quite opposite. You're going back into Maya again, going back into the material world. You're getting attached to material activities. I explained the other day also that there's two concepts of rasa. There's the rasa for the bhavuka, the real bhavuka, one who has bhava and prema, then he experiences rasa, the real relationship with the Lord. But we do have another rasa, that's the material rasa, which is expressed in dramas, material dramas, where you have expression of love affairs and wars and hatred and things like that taking place, or comedy or whatever. So we get all these rasas that are in the spiritual world, expressed in the material world also, and in dramas, and in real life. So all these different emotions are there. We have different type of loving relationships in the material world, relationships between friends, relationships between mothers and fathers and their children, relationships between husband and wife, or lovers, like Romeo and Juliet, or whatever. These are material relationships. And then we have the negative things like hatred and fear and everything also, and they all mix together. And this is creates life in the material world and drama in dramas and movies, etc. We get all these things mixed together. It's all material. It's another type of rasa. It's material rasa. So that is what is condemned by the Mayavadis. All rasa is going to be this type of rasa, which is entanglement in the material world. It increases our illusion and causes us more karma. So they reject all that. But they don't understand that there is spiritual rasa also. So they'll think that anything spiritual also is that same level of material rasa. And so, okay, Lord Chaitanya is doing all of this, it's all material, so he's a material, he's experiencing material rasa, material attachment. And therefore not good for a sannyasi. He's not following his dharma properly. So this was their conclusion on seeing him. Lord Chaitanya, of course, went a little bit beyond other Vaishnava sannyasis, what they do. Because we see in the other sampradayas that they also preserve some decorum of a sannyasi, and they also do study very greatly. They're very knowledgeable of scriptures, etc. And their usual activity is beyond studying, and that is, of course, they do their sadhana, worshiping the Lord, and preaching. They do give lectures, very nice lectures on, you know, Vaishnava philosophy, etc. But we don't see them dancing and singing. So this is something that Lord Chaitanya introduced as the Yuga Dharma. And even as a sannyasi, he did this, which was a little bit unheard of before this time. Even the Vaishnava sannyasi is a little more serious, but he was singing and dancing, not only himself, but among all these other people. He's with the other bhavukas, and he's singing and dancing, etc. So, therefore, his activity was quite unusual for a Mayavada sannyasi, so that's why they criticized him. So in the modern world, of course, this is carried over, and therefore we see even now, not in other countries, but in India, they still have this little bit of a prejudice. Why are they singing and dancing, etc.? Because even though singing and dancing for the Lord are accepted, you know, kirtan, etc., accepted in one level, it's also done in a very different way. So like the mandvas, for instance, have kirtan also. But if you look at their kirtan, it'll be a little strange for us to look at it. We have some old men there, and they're chanting a few mantras or something like that. And they have a little dance they do also like that, but it's all very formal. And it's not a thing that everybody participates in. It's only a few people are doing this, few elder men are doing this thing. So it's a very formal affair if they do it. Their kirtan looks quite different. And of course, they have some, let's say, classical kirtans also, using raga and tal, etc., that they do. So little different from our type of kirtan, even among the Vaishnavas, like that. So Lord Chaitanya introduced something which was quite revolutionary by introducing kirtan and the way we do it, chanting the holy name, opening up for everybody. So it became a common activity of all people, not just a few select people. And not only that, but they did the kirtan and are dancing together, etc. So quite a different movement he introduced. So naturally, other people will be a little bit puzzled by it or shocked by it, and even today, it's difficult for people to adapt to some extent. They see it and they're a little bit puzzled by this. People can get used to it. So in Bengal, it is nothing uncommon, because Lord Chaitanya was there and Nityananda was there and the other great acharyas were there, and they were doing kirtans and congregational chanting, nam sankirtan processions, etc. So people of Bengal and Bangladesh got very used to it. So it's the common practice there. So nothing unusual about that. But in other parts of India, it's still a little bit peculiar for some people. So anyway, that was the main criticism they had here. So that's the external, but of course the internal thing is that they didn't know Lord Chaitanya's philosophy, which is completely different. Once his activity with the Kalama, an illiterate, foolish Mayavada sannyasi, but actually his whole philosophy was completely different, completely opposed to the Mayavada philosophy. So we see that he also criticizes and attacks their philosophy here in Varanasi and also with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. He shows how the actual meaning of the Upanishads and the Vedanta Sutra is not what the Mayavadis interpreted as. It's quite different. And we see that he says that you're interpreting, you're doing lakshana, you're taking the indirect meaning of the words when you don't have to. When there's a direct meaning, take the direct meaning. when there's contradiction or something, then we have to take an indirect meaning. But if you use indirect meaning everywhere and say it doesn't mean this, it means this, or it means this instead, then you can make any meaning you want. So that's what the Mahāvāda uses lakṣaṇa to support their philosophy. So, in other words, the external activity was one contradiction, but actually internally they couldn't see, but Lord Chaitanya was completely opposed to their philosophy. He didn't accept their philosophy at all, even though he had the Mahāvāda dress. Okay, any question? Well, yeah, that's the other purpose, of course, to it's a philosophy for people who don't want to accept the personality of Godhead. We have the, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So there'll be adherence to these at all times in history, to some degree. But sometimes the impersonalists and the Brahmavadis are more prominent, and sometimes the Vaishnavas will be more prominent, or sometimes the yogis will be prominent like that. So they're all there, and in one sense it's bona fide to some degree. The reason that we oppose the Mahāvāda philosophy is that there's complete rejection of the form of the Lord and the personality of the Lord. Whereas with a Brahmavadi who isn't impersonalist, they may not reject it. They may prefer to merge in Brahman rather than to worship Krishna, but they don't reject the form of Krishna also. And that's the case of Sukadeva Goswami. He was a Brahmavadi or Atmaram, but he wasn't a Mahāvāda. So he didn't say the form of the Lord is illusion, the world is illusion, etc. He accepted the Supreme Lord, but he was absorbed in Brahman at the moment. But he could change. So it's more difficult for the Mahāvādis to change because they're also aparādis. Because they say the Lord is, it's all Maya, Sattva-gun. That's all it is. So difficult for them to change. So that's why the Vaishnavacharyas are constantly fighting with them. So why is it present, of course, is because people also like impersonalism. It's one step also towards personalism. That's why it's there in the Vedas. Jnana is a process to lead to bhakti because we understand we're not the material body, we're atma. So it's a step. But if we get caught there and we start offending by saying, okay, the form of the Lord's illusory, etc., then we can't progress any further. But if we just understand we're not the body, we're atma, in that sense we're Brahmavadis or whatever, no problem, we can go further than that by devotee association, go higher. So we can say it's the positive aspect, and it's one step towards bhakti or Vaishnav culture, but at the same time, if you emphasize the Mahāvāda philosophy too much, then you get into the aparād, and then it becomes destructive for yourself and other people. Or with Lord Chaitanya. Well, we don't worship Lord Chaitanya independently. And we worship him with Radha and Krishna because he is Krishna with the mood of Radha. So automatically there's Radha Krishna included in the worship. So, but in order to worship Radha Krishna, we can't do that independently either. We have to get qualified by worshiping Lord Chaitanya and get his mercy. So we want to worship them together. So then the mood with Lord Chaitanya is a little bit different. He is called audarja. His mood is audarja, or compassion, whereas Lord Chaitanya's is madhurya, very sweet. So he's compassionate, and that means that he likes to deliver everybody. So the devotees also pick up that mood of preaching and delivering everybody also, and leading them to Krishna, Radha and Krishna. So with Lord Chaitanya we worship him, but generally we don't worship him independently. So then one could develop, and often one will develop madhurya rasa, because Lord Chaitanya is got the mood of Radha, etc. but not necessarily. So Lord Chaitanya's associates were, we have some in Dasya Rasa, some in Sakya Rasa, some in Vatsalya Rasa, like his parents are in Vatsalya Rasa. We find Nityananda's associates were all in Sakya Rasa. And we even have a Sakya Rasa Sampradaya, a group of people. And there's a book written on developing Raganuga in Sakya Rasa for Krishna by following after Subal and Sridhama and other devotees like that, similar to those for Madhurya Rasa. So all these things are possible, but it's the prominence of Madhurya Rasa in Lord Chaitanya's movement.
Maharaj, you're speaking about how the philosophies changed over time, different incarnations that came. It seems like these days that Buddhism and like this whole thing of being spiritual but not religious is coming back and it's becoming like fashionable now, and like the whole New Age thing and Zen Buddhism and just being in the moment and stuff.
Yeah.
So my question is like, in this time, because before we had Sankaracharya came to kind of defeat this kind of philosophy, but in this time, is there going to be another avatar then, or is it just...
Lord Chaitanya is the avatar. Nowadays we have people in the Western world, particularly, they're into maybe Buddhism or whatever. Even scientists, or if they become a little religious, they get into Buddhism, right? Or maybe Shankara's philosophy, but nothing Vaishnavic at all. So this, of course, is nothing wrong with that in one sense, because they're not adherents of the philosophy so much. They're just trying to approach spiritual life not from a fanatical or limited point of view, which has become in the Western world like Christianity, etc. It's like it becomes very limited and almost material in its conception. So therefore, they're trying to get out of that, and they're trying to get a little higher than that. We can also say that it's probably a symptom of some sattva, because in sattva gun, your quality is prakasha, which means knowledge or revelation. So that doesn't mean material knowledge, it means we actually begin to appreciate the idea that we're not the body, we're the soul. And there is some atma which is non-material. So if we get to sattva good, there's a natural quality that you develop. So therefore, we're becoming interested in something spiritual, so to speak. But it's very general at that point. So that sattva does not allow one to realize and appreciate a Supreme Lord. That only comes with mercy of Vaishnavas and getting faith and that. So they can come to that level through sattva itself. So we see many people that become vegetarians or this or that, they're very peaceful. So this natural idea of something spiritual is okay, it's a natural symptom of sattva gun. Yeah. So if they become my bodies, of course, then they may become offensive, and that stops them. If they don't, then it's possible for them to go beyond that and to get to Vaishnavism. But they have to be cultivated, get the mercy of devotees, and get faith, and they can go higher. Mm-hmm. So it's got its negative and its positive aspects.
Raj, are there any parallels between the Islamic faith and Mayavad? Do you see they don't have things like
art
and music?
Well, actually, it's very similar to actually like Judaism, which it opposes like anything. But they use the same Old Testament as Judaism and Christianity, so it's much more similar to Christianity and Judaism. Of course, they don't accept the Christ as their savior, whatever. But it's very similar to Judaism in the aspect that they accept the one supreme God, but he has no form, no qualities, no activities except creation of the material world. So it's quite allied to the Judaic, philosophically to their thing. The custom-wise is a little different, but at least that much it is. So it is something like, it's not like Mayavada philosophy, because they don't accept a material world at all in Mayavada philosophy. It's all illusory. The jiva's material is illusory also, so they don't take that as illusory in Christianity or in Islam also. How it is similar to the Mayavada philosophy is, of course, the impersonal aspect of the Supreme Lord. No form, no qualities. But they do accept, he does create a material world, which Mayavadas don't accept. So we can say that it is kind of like the Brahman with a little bit of Paramatma feature in it. Because Paramatma is the creator of the material world. He glances over the Prakriti and then it produces, like, what is the Bible? He glanced over the waters of the deep and he separated land from water, and then he created human beings and all this sort of. It's quite similar to Mahavishnu glancing, etc. So they do accept activity of that Supreme Lord, even though they don't accept a form of the Lord. Now, in Christianity, they get a little more into the form because they accept Christ as a material embodiment of God somehow or other. He's a human form of God or representative of God, and then they worship Christ and they have a form of Christ, etc. So they accept the form of Christ, who is not God but very similar to God. And then they even have the God, Michelangelo, old man creating the material world in the Sistine Chapel, so they're not completely opposed to, but they call it metaphorical only. That's not actual God, it's a symbol of God that they're representing in the church. Whereas Islam is, no, we can't even have a symbol of it at all. Nothing. So they're a little more, determined not to have any forms at all of God or anything like that. Whereas they'll do something in Christianity like that. But so some Christians also will reject that. So they won't have a form of Christ in their church also. The Protestants, I think, don't have forms of Christ in the church either. Whereas in Catholic Church, they will have Christ and they'll have Mary and so many things there. But the Protestants, generally, they don't have those forms at all again. So. It's difficult. So that's why in Bhagavad Gita chapter 12, when Arjuna asked the question, should we concentrate on the Brahman or should we just worship you in devotion? And he says, it's easier to simply do bhakti and worship the Lord because we have bodies and we want to do activity. And to do this inactive Brahman and to meditate on that is very, very difficult for an embodied soul to do. So very, very difficult. And then again, they said that they think they're liberated, but they fall. So they mukta manina, they think they're liberated, but because they actually say the Lord is illusory, they offend the Lord, and then they fall from their position. So then they become attracted to do material activities again. So difficult for them to maintain that, but they're, for some of them, the goal is simply to get out of the material world. So that's their main goal. You stop the karma, stop the material body, etc. So they strive for mukti.
Thank
I think one devotee, Airavata, wrote a comparison between the Quran and the Bhagavata or something like that. I don't know what his conclusions were, but he wrote one book on that also. But for the strict or the common Muslims or the common Muslim scholars, they will probably reject that because say that's sometimes there are literary devices we use in our scriptures also, so it's not the absolute, it's just a relative statement, those statements about the form of God or the color of God, etc. They'll say, actually, is no form. In Christianity also, you'll see a few references to a form of God or a color of God in the Old Testament, but then the scholars will say, well, we can't take it literally.
Well, it seems that
I could be wrong on that, but the original two roots of religion there, Judaism and Hinduism, from which Christianity and everything came through.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you analyze the behavior of those two roots of religion, they don't preach. Originally, Hinduism doesn't preach many miles, but they don't preach. I mean, Christianism, they probably use some kind of conversion from counting the glory of the Lord. But it seems like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was the first one to actually expound the actual glory of the Lord rather than conversion. So because Hinduism and Judaism, they don't even get out of the church. They just say they're not being...
Well, not all of them. Some of them are going door to door, you know. Yeah.
But not the Hindus.
Oh, the Hindus. Yeah, generally the Hindus don't. But Shankaracharya wandered all over India preaching his philosophy and defeating all the great scholars and then going to the courts of the kings, and he got the greatest scholars to defeat them, and then the king had to convert to Mahayana philosophy also. So he went all over, and then we see the Vaishnavas like Ramanujacharya did the same thing, and Madhva. They walked everywhere, all over India, up into the Himalayas, down all over. Madhva went twice to the Himalayas and all the way back, and he was always defeating all the other people, the Mayavadis, etc., etc. So Ramanuja the same. So they were preachers also, in one sense, and then the only reason their movement spread is because of preaching. So the Mayavadi spread because they began preaching and extending themselves and defeating people in arguments everywhere like this. And that's what the Buddhists did also. How did Ashok, he must have preached to him, he became a Buddhist also. And it became very prominent, you know, they converted a huge section of the Vaishyas, I think. And they became Buddhists because there were so many Vaishyas in India and the Brahmins were suppressing them, so they all became Buddhists. So that took preaching also. So of course there's social reasons why they converted, etc. But they did have the preachers in all these different movements. And then Buddhism, someone from China came over and then he took it over back to China and he started in China and they started a movement there in China and grew in China also. So another preacher from India actually, they came also. A Bodhidharma came from India and he went to China and he established a movement there. And that spread all over China, and then it went to Japan also, and then someone came over from China to Japan, and they spread it there. So there were Buddhists had preachers, and...
But it seems like no one before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu actually expounded the glory of the Supreme Lord. They went and did the nitty-nitty thing.
Well, the Mayavadis will do that. The Buddhas, I think Buddhism spread because, not because of the philosophy, but because of their more social idea, the kindness to all living entities, etc. Follow the, you know, the what is the middle path, etc. And you know, moral philosophy and things like that. And that's mainly that's the reason why Mayavada philosophy is popular today. They don't care about the philosophy. They preach morality. They've converted and they preach morality also there. Even you know, the Shankaracharya would give his New Year's speech. It says, "Be good, be kind, be compassionate." You know, this moral lecture.
The question would be more like, do you think that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is unique in his approach of presenting to the population, to the mass in general, the glories of the Supreme Lord? Because all those you mentioned, they reduce the population to either don't do this, don't do that, be a good boy.
Yeah.
Even the Christians, they say the same thing.
Yeah.
Do you major? But they don't actually go down.
Yeah. We can see it.
Did anyone in any religious system between those two, did anyone actually ever profound the glory of Supreme Lord positively?
Yeah. Well, that's what the Madhvacharya did, and Ramanujacharya, they also did this. They were completely opposed to Shankara. This is all nonsense. The Lord is a person, you know, and you approach him by bhakti, etc. So they also did that. But they did it in a more philosophical way. They had debates with the Mayavadis or with others, and they defeated them. That's how they did it. Lord Chaitanya was not so much interested in the debating aspect. He just went out and did kirtan everywhere. So we can say the approach to glorifying the Lord was much different. It was Nam Sankirtan, which is public. He took it down to the not to the intellectuals and to the king's court and to the Mayavadis, but he was just among the people and doing the kirtan. So that's what happened there. Not only Lord Chaitanya, at this time also then we have other people I think in Maharashtra there was Tukaram, other parts of India, they were also starting this like a mass movement of kirtan and things like that, and preaching to the people in general rather than to a select group of intellectuals or philosophers or scholars. So to preach to, you can't preach philosophy to the mass of people, that, the Vaishyas and Sudras or whatever, huh? But you can do kirtan and you can convince them by that. So that's how you can get support from the majority of the people. But you cannot ignore the intellectuals also. So Lord Chaitanya has a philosophy, and therefore he does debate with the Mayavadis also, plus he has the other movement where he's doing the kirtan.
In times of like calamity or like problems going on in the world at the moment, and like we're told to like kind of close ourselves off from the world, but at the same time we have the instruction of performing Yuga Dharma and Harinam. So how do you suggest we regulate that, or understand that through Shastra, or whether it's just like following the political idea of
Well, we can take like the example like Russia under the communists. They couldn't do Nam Sankirtan on the street. If you do, you get thrown in jail. Of course, some tried it. They were distributing. They were so courageous and stubborn. They were distributing books on the street in spite of the fact that they knew they were going to get arrested. They got arrested and they got thrown in jail and they had to go to concentration camps or whatever like that. So, you know, you take that risk if you're going to do things like that. So. You have to, in such situations, generally use our intelligence and try to find other ways of preaching. If we can't do that, if it becomes illegal or for any reason it's not proper, then we have to find other means also. Of course, we hope these things are temporary, as it was in Russia, but even now in Russia, they've passed laws again that I think more than so many people cannot congregate together. They have a rule like that even now in Russia. You can't congregate together in bigger groups more than 15 or something like that. They could arrest you like that. And three years ago they passed that law. But it was not mainly for us, it was for the Jehovah Witnesses. But anyway, there are, you know, different countries. So you have to be a little careful in how you do these different things according to the laws of the country. Otherwise you get more problems. So we hope this is temporary now at the present time. But as much as possible we should try to restrict yourself for some time and take advantage. I think Vaisheshika said, this is a good chance because everybody's sitting in their house. So now you distribute books over the internet and read Bhagavatam. Get them to read something. At least they're sitting in their house and they're all bored, so you sell them sets of Bhagavatam. So this is the thing he's into now. He said actually they were going out and they would go to houses and people wouldn't open the doors, you know. They're scared, they're speaking through the thing, and then they would preach to them over the thing, and then he would convince them. And finally they would take a set of books, but they wouldn't open the door, so you had to leave it there, and then they would open the door when you're not there, and they would take the books inside. But they were selling Bhagavatams like that last week in America. So there's always different ways of doing, you know, preaching. So that's one way that Vaisheshika found that you could actually do over internet also. And he said it may be a big thing to start this. And once we started, even after there's no epidemic or whatever, still may continue. And it may outdo the normal preaching on the street and book distribution, the internet preaching, and the taking subscriptions or Bhagavatam over the internet may turn into a bigger thing in the future, even without the plague.
Just thinking now, that could be a very good campaign. There's 560 million books at least out there, over half a billion books. If you just this opportunity to encourage people to find a Hare Krishna book in your house and read it.
Yeah, if they got a book to read it, if they don't have it, order one.
That could be a nice campaign, an internet campaign. Find a Hare Krishna book and read it.
Now this is the real antivirus. It's the antivirus. Okay. Hare Krishna.